Good evening. My name is Paul, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic. And I'm not from Laguna Hills. That's where the old folks are. I'm from Laguna Niguel, right next door. Yeah. And it was a long trip getting here, but I'm glad to be here. Actually, it is a long trip getting here from where I was. You can't hardly never get here from there. And it's been a great day and a great meeting up to this point. And I love meetings where it's crowded, where the alcoholics are crowded together, where the room is too small for whatever the number of alcoholics are, because alcoholics crowded together generate a lot of energy, a lot of love, and I feel that, and I enjoy that, and I feel sorry for people that have to stand, but then a little voice says, "What the hell? You've got to stand." And I'll drink to it. Yeah. Welcome happy birthday to the birthday people. I love birthdays. In fact, I was at a potluck birthday meeting just before coming here, and they all stayed and had the rest of the party, and I said, well, somebody's got to go out and do the work while the rest of us party. It's a potluck, and these women out, they compete with each other to see who can make the richest dessert. And Max hasn't been feeling well, so I was getting her plates for her. So instead of getting a dessert plate, I got a big plate. And since I was getting hers, I got mine too, and I got two big plates. And since I didn't know which dessert she wanted, I got some of each for her. And since I was getting it for her anyway, I got some of each for me too. And then Max couldn't eat her, so I had to help her with it. I've been trying to fatten her up because she's lost 12 pounds weight, and I'm getting fat on her diet. But it's been a real good day. I got a lot of work done today, and it started out with, that's my bragging story. It started out with my 40 minutes on my treadmill. This has nothing to do with AA now, so if you're newcomers, don't pay attention for a little while. This is my bragging story. I am the only 80-year-old I know who has worn out his treadmill before it wore him out. 5 years ago, I bought a treadmill, and I don't pay much attention to service contracts. Don't think much of service contracts, but I thought with a treadmill, I think I'll get a service contract, and I did. And I wore out the tread, and they replaced it. And I wore out the main bearing, and they replaced that. And I wore out something else, and they replaced that. And then the company that made the treadmill went out of business. But that, as I reminded them, that didn't put my service contract out of business. So they said, you go back to Montgomery Ward, you pick out the best treadmill you can find, and let us know which one it is. We'll come pick it up and deliver it to you. We'll pick up the old one, take it away. And I now am in the process of trying to wear out my second treadmill. And 40 minutes at 3.6 miles per hour every day, 7 days a week. And as a matter of fact, the latter part of last week, I renewed my service contract. I sent in my payment, and I'm forced to continue to use the treadmill until at least July the 1st, 2001, because I got money invested in it. And so that's my bragging story. I want to congratulate the newcomers. I want to welcome the visitors. I want to welcome the newcomers. We saw a fairly nice looking crop of newcomers tonight. We're really glad you're here. We're glad you're here because, for one thing, Bill W., one of the co-founders of AA, said that carrying the message of recovery was our primary aim and the chief reason for our existence. And that is a pretty strong word, primary aim and chief reason for our existence. And I thought, when he says our existence, does he mean us as individuals or us as groups or both? But apparently there's nothing more important we can do than carry the message of recovery. We carry it to each other. That's just being at a meeting is one of the ways of carrying the message. There's hundreds of ways of carrying the message. Living out there sober as a sober member of AA is a profound way of carrying the message. All kinds of ways. But carrying the message to newcomers is a particular appeal to us. As a matter of fact, I've often said I'd keep coming back to AA even if it wasn't keeping me sober, just to see what happens to the newcomers. Because it's fun to watch the light come on and watch the whole family recover in that. And I like that. And so we're glad you're here. We're really glad you're here. In fact, we're so glad you're here, we don't care that you're not glad you're here. As a matter of fact, if you're delighted to be here, if you're really happy, 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 happy to be here, we may not be able to help you. But if you can think of 1,000 things you'd rather do and a lot of places you'd rather be, and you think this whole thing is corny and silly, and you sing happy birthday to people and they stand up there and all that silly stuff. And especially if you think your case is different. The sad part about that is that makes you one of us. You're supposed to feel you don't belong. So keep coming back. Besides, there's no place else to go. I mean, this is it. This is the bottom of the barrel. And also, I was happy to hear that you have court cards here. You sign court cards. I mean, signing court cards is not part of the AA program, but we do it as a service to the courts, and we like to cooperate with the people who are getting a nudge from the judge. And I particularly like the court cards because one night I was talking up in Riverside. The meeting must have been close to a courthouse or something. And up there, when you're waiting to talk, you sit up front at the main table with the leaders and the officers of the group and the important people. And while I was sitting there with nothing better to do while they were getting around waiting for me to talk, I sat there and had a basket and I counted the court cards. And there were 21 court cards. But only one newcomer. So ever since then, I have been in the habit of welcoming the non-alcoholic drunk drivers. We're really glad you're here. And I, for one, hope you stay here till I get home. Keep coming back. And in case you didn't know it, you can sign your own court card, too, if you wanted to. But I won't tell you that, because that'd be a dumb thing to tell you. I enjoyed this meeting so far. I enjoyed Earl, enjoyed what he had to say, enjoyed the birthday, enjoyed everything. I enjoyed the readings. I enjoyed the readings. I always enjoy the readings at a meeting, especially like tonight when Paul screwed up chapter 3. I like the screw-ups. Because that's what I remember. I mean, if they say it just the way it is, like, yeah, you don't hear it at all. But make a mistake, and boom, we're right awake. Yeah. Oh, what did he say? I really remember the screw-ups. Last night, I was at a meeting last night, and somebody read the steps, and she says, step 6, sought through prayer and mediation. Sought through prayer and mediation. Sought through prayer and mediation. I myself have read the steps at a meeting as sought through prayer and medication. I remember the time I was leading a meeting, I had this older woman reading chapter 5, and she read it as, what an odor. One of the best mistakes I ever heard is the guy that's reading the traditions, and he said the only requirement for membership is a desire to start drinking. I that makes a lot more sense than the way it's written. So anyhow, another thing I did today was working on a fireproof box safe combination, working out the combination of the thing. I bought it yesterday at Office Depot. And I said, I'll buy this safe if you deliver it out to my car for me. Cause I didn't want to carry the thing. And they said, okay. And they got a big husky guy, and he got this big box. He ran down on a dolly, and he picked this big box up, and he went to put it in the trunk, and it wouldn't get in, and he turned it one way, and he shoved it in, slammed it in, and bent the top of the thing down, and it went in. And he says, are you going to have some help getting that out? I said, it's the only way it's going to get out is by getting help. And so I got home, and took home the rest of the stuff out of the house, and I thought, I'll look at the trunk and see what this problem is here, and so I can figure out which one of my sponsees I'll invite to come by for a little of the message. This thing, who there are the various sizes and strengths, and this big box was in there, and I pulled it up to see how it was going, and where it went in, it bent the top of the lid part down, but when you tried to pull it out, it wouldn't bend up, so there's no way to get it out that way. And I'm looking at this little old widow neighbor lady comes trudging by and says, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to get this big box out of here, and it's too big to get out. I won't be able to get it out. And she says, can I help? And I thought, for Christ's sake, of course you can't help. My God, you know. Who do you think you are? And I didn't say that. I said, well, no, it won't come out, because then I pulled on the top to sure that it hit the top and it wouldn't come out. And she says, well, what about if you lifted it from the bottom out? And I thought, what the hell good would that do? It's the same size at the bottom as it is at the top. For God's sake, why don't you go on and mind your own business? But I didn't say that. I grabbed hold of the body to pull it up to show her that it wouldn't work, and I pulled it up, and it flipped out of the car and almost fell on the floor. I hate women like that, you know. I took it in the house myself. I hid it so nobody could see it again. That was gross for me, though, because I only thought the things I was thinking. I didn't say them. I only thought them. Usually, most of the time before, I blurt things out. And my mouth gives me most of my trouble in life. I mean, from what I put in it and from what comes out of it. You know, my mouth is my problem. Oh, speaking of that, I guess I should talk about drinking. This is an AA meeting. And people notice that if you don't drink. And they also notice if you don't get sober before the meeting's over. But I used to drink, but I wasn't an alcoholic. Of course I drank. You can't not drink. We live in a drinking society. I mean, you can't be a doctor and not drink. And just like I found that you can't be a construction worker and not work and drink. I mean, and not work. You can't, it reminds me of Earl, living in Life's Not a Bed of Wine and Roses. You can't be a newspaper person. You can't drive a truck and not drink. You can't be a carpenter and not drink. You can't do a lot of things and not drink. And in fact, that was one of the things I really noticed early in sobriety. I met a cocktail waitress, a working cocktail waitress, who was sober in AA. And I thought, boy, that's something. And then I met a guy who he and his brother owned a chain of liquor stores, and they were sober in AA. And I thought, wow, that's something. Met a clerk, an AA sober member who was a clerk in a liquor store, and he didn't drink. And met bartenders who were sober and didn't drink. And I thought, geez, you could be almost anything and stay sober in this program. I was really impressed with that. But back in the first days, I was drinking, but I wasn't one of those dumb alcoholics who did all these, knew what they were doing and did it anyway. But I wasn't an alcoholic, but I had a lot of morning sickness. I found out, though, that was due to the fact that I had mixed my drinks. You should never mix your drinks. It makes you sick. So I was careful not to mix my drinks, but I still had morning sickness. And I found out that was because I had drunk on an empty stomach. They'll tell you, you should never drink on an empty stomach. And so I was careful not to drink on an empty stomach and not to mix my drinks. And I still got sick. But that was because I got some bad booze. There's a lot of bad booze out there. And God bless the AA research workers who keep checking it out periodically. Apparently they're not making it any better today than they ever did. And I'm glad they keep testing it. Somebody keeps testing it. And I remember specifically up at the Royal Hawaiian, across from Disneyland Hotel. Somebody gasping a sigh of relief over there. I remember we drank up there one night at a big bar, big circular bar, big round circular bar. People all the way on this. And at the Royal Hawaiian, you drink rum. And boy, and in the next morning, I was really sick. And I thought to myself, my God, that must be really rotten rum that they drink up there. I mean, isn't it amazing that place could sell such rotten rum and stay in business? And then I realized all those people were sitting around that bar. I thought, geez, and you could tell just by looking at them that they were there every night. And how come they don't get sick? And the answer came to me right away. They were the alcoholics. Yeah, they were alcoholics, but I wasn't an alcoholic because I drank the good stuff. So I had no more problem with that. I just didn't go back to the Royal Hawaiian anymore. And I also used to drink before I went to church dinner dances. I hate church dinner dances. No, I live in a small town. We are in a pharmacy, a neighborhood drugstore in a small town, Alliance, Ohio. And when you're in a small town like that, you have to go to all the church functions. You have to go to church dinner dances. You have to be a part of those things. And I hate them. I hate them. There's a lot of people at church dinner dances. And they want you to talk to them. You have to talk. You have to chit-chat. You have to sit all through the dinner and chit-chat. I don't like to chit-chat. And you have to dance. You can't not dance at a church dinner dance. Because you're sitting there, minding your own business, looking very comfortable, like Craig. A little better looking, a little better dressed, but you're minding your own business. And every church dinner has at least one hyperactive woman who comes running up to you and says, "Come on, Paul, let's dance." And you very politely say, "No thanks, I can't dance." And they say, "Oh, sure you can." And they drag you out on the floor and prove to the whole world that you can't dance. Didn't we pay the electric bill or something? Quit leaning on the light switch. Anyhow, what I did with that, I used to have a few drinks. I didn't realize I was doing it at the time. But you have to drink at least one drink at a church dinner dance. If you don't drink, they'll know you have a problem. And you can't drink too much because they count your drinks. So I would have a few drinks before I went to church dinner dance. I'd have one drink while I was at church dinner dance. I'd have more drinks when I got home to celebrate how successfully I'd gotten through with the one drink. But I would have those drinks before I went to the church dinner dance. It would relax me mentally and physically. It would relax me mentally, and I could chit-chat. I could chit-chat real good. I was a good chit-chat. Yeah. And relax me physically, and I could dance. I was a real good dancer. Today, I don't drink, and I don't dance. But in retrospect, I didn't know it was happening when it was happening, but in retrospect, looking back, then I could see that the two got out of sync. Maybe I hadn't begun to relax mentally yet, and I'd begin to get too relaxed physically. Might begin by affecting my speech. And I would talk slowly and deliberately so nobody would notice. Or I would get completely relaxed. I mean, just a trip, nothing to trip. But I might find myself lying there on the floor, looking very serene. Yeah. And then I say, "Get up, you fool. People will think you're drunk." Yeah. And my body would say, "What do you mean, get up? We're paralyzed from the ears down." Yeah. And I would think, "Isn't that strange? I have never known anybody that drank as little as you did and got paralyzed from the ears down. You must be very sensitive to this." I thought, I'll have to ask somebody about that sometime. I was thinking maybe of an allergy professor or something, but I never found anybody to ask. You can't ask just anybody a question like that. They're very prone to say, "Well, I don't know why it does that, but if it did that to me, I just wouldn't drink it anymore." I didn't want to know what to do about it. I just want to know why it did that. And then there were other times that I hadn't even begun to relax physically yet, and I'd get too relaxed mentally. It would be like I'd be off doing something, and all my brain cells would get together and say, "Ah, what the hell? He's drinking. Let's go home and go to bed." And my body would go on doing things. You know? And in the morning, I couldn't recall what I'd been doing when my brain was home in bed. And in fact, I never have figured out how to recall something that wasn't recorded at the time that it happened. So the longer I drank, the more things got confused and got out of hand. And I didn't really have a drinking problem. I had a sleeping problem. In fact, I found early that I'd go to pharmacy school all day, come home, work in the family drugstore all the evening, study till midnight, 1, 2 o'clock. Jump in bed, sleep real fast, and wake up, jump in bed and be half awake and half asleep, and wake up tired and stupid, is what I meant to say. And I found out that I could, at the end of the study period, chug-a-lug two beers, jump in bed, sleep real fast, and wake up smart. And I graduated from pharmacy school with honors, and then graduated third in the class in medical school, because with the aid of alcohol to help me sleep. And in fact, every drug I ever took, every medication, every alcohol, every chemical I ever took worked. But because it worked, every time it worked, then I was more dependent on it. I felt the harder it was for me to think I could get along without it. And the more I used it, the more it took to get the same effect. And the shorter and shorter the effect lasted, so I had to repeat it at increasingly intervals. And I had to get it more often and more of it. And over a period of time, I began to have side effects. So I had other chemicals to counteract the side effects so I could keep on taking the drugs I was taking. And so better living through chemistry became a way of life for me. And as a matter of fact, I went to medical school. I was in pharmacy school. I mean, I was a pharmacist, but the neighborhood drugstore, the people didn't seem all that impressed with my degree. And I wanted to go to pharmacy medical school. And I was in the Depression. There was no money to go to medical school. My family didn't want me to go to medical school. They wanted me to stay home and run the family drugstore. And so my solution was to marry the girl next door and suggest that she work my way through medical school. And she did, and I did. And I got a medical degree, and people didn't seem all that impressed with my medical degree. And I thought they'd be more impressed if I had a specialty degree. So I said to her, I said, you're doing a good job, kid. You keep on working, and we'll get us a medical degree, a specialty degree. And she did, and I did, and I specialized in internal medicine, diagnosis of medical diseases. That used medicines to cure. They didn't treat kids, couldn't stand kids, and didn't do any surgery, couldn't stand inside the blood. As a diagnostician, I knew how to treat things medically. In that. And of course, Max, having worked all those years, thought the least I could do was let her work in my office for 30 years. No money, of course. And I thought that was the least I could do. And as a matter of fact, Max and I today, last December was our last wedding anniversary. We were 59-year wedding anniversary. And we made a mutual agreement that this year, the 60th year, was going to be the best year of our marriage. And we've both been working on that and focusing on that. And for one thing, we no more bringing up the past. No more of saying, well, you always do or you never do. Just living in today, none of the past. And no fault finding, no complaining. Just trying to add to each other's life. And it's working real well, working real well. I haven't screwed it up badly so far this year. And we're going to keep that up. Anyhow, I kept taking more chemicals. I remember one time I woke up and I thought to myself, my God, what would you do for a patient that feels as rotten as you do? And immediately I thought, well, I'd give them something to pep them up. And I started taking some amphetamines. First I took the appetite appeasers. So they had an upper and a downer in it. And I thought, what are you taking a downer for when you're trying to get upper? So I left the downer out. I was taking straight amphetamines. I'm not here to advertise pills, but I do feel that amphetamines deserve a little honorable mention. And I don't know that I would have had the stamina to have completed my pre-AA training period if it weren't for the amphetamines. They did affect my hearing in that I couldn't listen fast enough to hear what I was saying. Another time I find myself saying something, I think, what are you saying that again for? You've already said it four times. I don't know. It just sounds so good, I think I'll say it again. Blah, 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 blah. And I made my mouth so dry I could hardly spit. And but I never became addicted to pills. I was never hooked on pills. I mean, what do you mean, ho, 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 ho? I know I wasn't addicted because I didn't abuse the pills. I mean, you ask any doctor how his patients get addicted to pills, he'll tell you two things. One, he'll tell you is that none of his patients ever get addicted to pills. And he'll tell you the other thing is that you can't get addicted to pills unless you abuse the pills. You have to abuse the pills in order to become addicted to them. And I don't even know how to abuse a pill. I mean, how do you abuse a pill? You throw it up against the wall, you know, you hop on the thing, or you verbally abuse it. Why, you dirty, rotten little child, why didn't you do what I told you? You know, they were just little tiny pills. Just to look at them, you could tell they were very mild. And never abused a pill in my life. In fact, I was even very careful where I carried my pills. I put them with my change. And people say, you got change for a dollar? And I say, yeah. And I go like that. And they say, oh, you carry Tylenol, Tylenol. Anything at all. So I put it over with my keys. And I'd go to get in the car, and I'd take the keys out of my pocket. And the Quaalude, run down the street. You know. And the damn thing would always run faster than I could run. You know. And I didn't dare stop on it, or I'd abuse it. You know. So I treated my pills with great respect. You know. And I... But that progression of the better living, the ultimate of me doing things to try to get to sleep at night, well, I was finally injecting Amitol in my vein at night. I'd keep it in the bag in the car, in the garage. The garage was attached to the house, thank God. And I would squirt it in and try to figure out how much can I squirt in. I squirt it in, take it out, turn it out, throw it in the bag, thing, bag in the car, slam the car door, run down the hall so I could jump in bed. And it was hard to time it. And the bad part of it was, too, that when you take the needle out of the vein, you're supposed to put a sterile dressing on the Band-Aid on that. And I didn't have time for any of that formal stuff. I would take it out and I'd hold my arm up like this and hope gravity would take care of everything with one hand. And I'd start running down the hall like this and I'd run into my wife and try to act casual, you know. It's hard to be casual when you're in a hurry. So one night I had I didn't take anything to get to sleep, and the next morning I had a convulsion. And Max was real excited. And she called a doctor friend in the next block and came and they called an ambulance and took me off to the ambulance. Max rode in the ambulance with me. Got to the hospital. I was on the staff of the hospital, but I wouldn't stay unless they let Max stay with me. So the little boy stayed in the hospital, and his mommy stayed in the bed next to him. And they got me to stay in the hospital for two nights, I think. And I didn't like it there, so I decided to sign out. Went back to see this doctor, and I explained to him that problems were strictly marital. Now, that was my second convulsion. In fact, I was back in the bedroom. Max heard me back there, and she was out in the kitchen. She walked back to the bedroom and watched me convulse. She sat on the edge of the bed, was watching me convulse. And when I got through, she said, "You've had a convulsion. You better go to bed." And she hadn't even been to Al-Anon yet. here I was telling you, I was seeing this convulsive specialist. He's a specialist in convulsions. And he had the best qualified neurologist in Orange County, and he was giving me Dilantin and phenobarbital for epilepsy. He didn't know why I had convulsions, and he didn't think to ask me if I drank, and I didn't think to tell him. And he was giving me Dilantin and phenobarbital. I knew what was wrong. I had daily headaches, real bad headaches, high blood pressure, diabetes, sense of impending insanity. I thought I was losing my mind. I had convulsions. I was losing weight. I thought, geez, I need a good medical workup. I need to see a good diagnostician. Well, I happened to be the best diagnostician I knew. So I sat down and I did some lab work on me. I did a bit of physical exam on me and I had a consultation with me. I went over all these symptoms and it was obvious. I had a brain tumor. Ha yourself. There's nothing funny about a brain tumor. I'd die and you'd all be sorry, by God. And this neurologist had trained at the Mayo Clinic, so he sent me back to the Mayo Clinic. Went back there in December of 1966, and which is a great time to go to Rochester, Minnesota. And on the last day, ninth day, I went back to get my lab reports and have them tell me that I had an inoperable brain tumor and I would die. And at the last minute, he says, "Well, there's one last thing. I think you ought to see our staff psychiatrist." And I thought, well, that's a dumb place to look for my brain tumor. But then I realized they'd looked a lot of other funny places for my brain tumor. So I said, had no other choice. I said, okay. Next thing I know, I saw the staff psychiatrist. Next thing I knew, I was locked up in the Mayo Clinic nut ward. Which had really surprised me because Max had been ill for a long time. I'd sent her to four different psychiatrists, and when it ended up in the nut ward, I really wasn't all that surprised. But when that steel door slammed shut and she was the one that went home, I was amazed. And I didn't like it there. I signed out of that dump. I went back to California where they treat me with more respect. Called the neurologist, told him about psychiatrists, sent me to a psychiatrist here. He talked to me for 45 minutes, talked to Max for 10 minutes, and he locked me up in the local network. Up at St. Joseph's Hospital, the Rush Center. Not because people are rushing to get in, rushing to get out. And that's a dump. It's not, it's really a great place. The only thing is, they're fanatics up there. They're really fanatics on leather belts. You can't get out of there. it's really part of the program. I'm sure if they had a Senate investigation, they would find that there are people that have been there for years. And, they won't let them out until they make a leather belt or an ashtray or something useful. And they're really fanatics. They try to convince me that the quality of my life would improve if I learned how to make leather belts. I didn't understand the philosophy, and besides, I didn't understand the instructions. In fact, I remember sitting there in a nut ward, commiserating with myself. That's a series of misdiagnoses, mismanagement, medical, bad breaks, and things that have happened that a nice guy like me ended up in a place like that. And while I was thinking that, this dumb psychiatrist walked up behind me and wanted to know if I'd be willing to talk to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, God Almighty, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? But I could tell by the look in his face that he thought it was a good idea. And, I don't know if you know that or not, but happiness on a nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. And I was willing to go to any length to make him happy. And I said, yes. And in no time at all, this clown comes galloping into the room, yelling at the top of his voice, "My name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic." Ha 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 ha. I was really quite embarrassed for him. Told an interminable story, on and on, loud voice, yelling at the top of his voice. I don't remember a word he said, except how he ended it. He finally said, "Well, that's my story. I'm going to a meeting tonight. Would you like to go along?" And I said, "Hell no, I won't like it. But I'll go." Because I figured he'd go back and squeal to that dumb psychiatrist. And I don't know what meeting we went to. Until, I don't know how long we went to meetings before I knew what meeting I was at. And but I know that meeting had a profound effect on the psychiatrist. He now developed a suspicious, intense interest in my program, right? Wonder, what's this about a book? What's this about the steps? What's this about meetings? How often do they have meetings? What other kind of meetings do they have? How often are you going to go to meetings? When's the next time you're going to meet? I thought, my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. He's ashamed to go, so he's sending me. So I then thought, I wanted to go every meeting I could. And I was after Frank take me every night. Frank was going to take me every night, except he wasn't so sure about Friday. Friday night he thought he might have a date with his now wife, Carolyn. And I thought, well, that's a crummy way to run an organization. And I reported him to the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist got another attorney to take me on Friday night. And I got to enough meetings that I got enough brownie points, I got discharged. And I had no intention of going back to AA anymore. Why should I? I wasn't even an alcoholic. Now that I knew all it was about drinking and all that, I just wouldn't drink, I guess. Or, although I did drink. I kept on drinking. And as a matter of fact, speaking of the psychiatrist, I love drunkalogs. I love stories about AA stories. Because I love the recovery theory, I love anything that displays the power of this program. And that the psychiatrist is an example of that to me. It was Dr. David Geddes up on 17th Street in Santa Ana. he's the one that tricked me into coming to AA. Yeah. He's not an alcoholic. The story is that when he was a resident and learning to be a psychiatrist, somebody got the bright idea that he'd be a better psychiatrist if he went to some AA meetings. And he said he had to go to three AA meetings. And he went to those meetings as a resident before he became a psychiatrist, and he was so impressed that now that's his favorite thing as a psychiatrist. He runs around with his butterfly net and captures alcoholics and sends them to AA. And he won't even try to work with them the first year. He figures he's not going to try to do for them what AA can do better. And maybe after a year, if they're flaky enough, he may try to help them then. But he's really convinced that AA is the answer. And every year on my birthday, I send him a birthday card and tell him sending me to AA is one of the smartest things he ever did. And he writes me back a note and says, yeah, I know. And we both agree on that. And anyhow, there I was, out of the hospital. I had no intention of going back to AA anymore, but I found out that Max liked AA. In fact, I'd say, let's go to a movie. She said, no, let's go to an AA meeting. And once I found out she liked it, then I would, if she wouldn't shape up, then I decided I wasn't going to go to AA anymore. Well, I said that once too often, and she got in the car. We lived in Anaheim and came to meetings here in Garden Grove, so we wouldn't run into anybody we knew, and she couldn't drive the freeways. But somehow she would do that. She got in the car and she would come on down here and go to the meetings, either here at the Canyon Club or over at the Women's Club. And have you ever tried that? Have you ever tried sitting at home on a Saturday night drinking while your non-alcoholic partner is off laughing it up in an AA meeting? I thought it was very rude. And I had to come back to the meetings to find out what the alcoholics were laughing about. And it didn't make sense to me. They were laughing at things they ought to be ashamed of. And crying at things they ought to be laughing about. And I kept coming back to see what they were laughing about for 7 months. And then I went to one meeting too many. And I found myself laughing with them. And I haven't had a drink since. And that seems to be the way it has worked for me, that the laughter is very much a part of my recovery. Indeed, I'm convinced that my higher power laughs every time he hears alcoholics and Al-Anons laugh, even if he doesn't understand the joke. And I think he likes for me to enjoy the life that he's worked so hard to push me into. And he feels good when I feel good. And he likes for me to be enthusiastic about this program and this way of life. And so there I was, new in AA. And new in sobriety, I mean. And this is when people were saying about stick with the winners. And I thought, well, if I'm going to stick with the winners, I better find out what a winner is. And so I asked Chuck C., who at that time was sober about 100 years. And I said, what's a winner? And I was surprised when he had to think about it for a while. And then he said, well, I guess you have to die sober. And I thought, die sober. I've never been very enthusiastic about any accolades I could win by dying. In fact, I had always planned on being a saint. I'd gotten the book, The Lives of the Saints, big, thick book. I was reading The Lives of the Saints, trying to pick out which saint was going to be my role model. And until I found out you have to be dead X number of years before they'll declare you a saint. And I thought, well, screw that. In fact, I took that sainthood seriously. I even had a humility belt. I got a lot of humility out of that belt. I put a leather belt, and I put a tax through it with a tax pointing in. And you didn't wear it to hold your trousers up. You put it under your clothes against your skin so that the tax stuck into you. And I got a lot of humility out of that belt because the tax was sticking, you'd bleed. And the blood would run down your leg and collect in your shoes. And you wear it long enough, it would squish when you walk. I got tremendous humility out of that belt. I never wore it because it was uncomfortable, but it was. I've always had good intentions. I'm one of the best intentioned people you'll ever meet. I've always been proud of my good intention. In fact, I've even been proud of my humility. I was being introduced a short time back, and the fellow introducing me remarked about what a humble person I was. And I was really delighted that he mentioned that, because I'm proud of my humility. I am. I mean, I was glad he mentioned it, because I'll tell you, there's just nothing more boring than being humble and not having anybody notice it. It's a real drag. Anyhow, I decided maybe I wasn't going to be a winner, but I thought I'll be a successful member of AA. I didn't make a decision to be a successful member of AA to anybody but myself. And over the years, I've perhaps altered my definition of successful member of AA to some extent. But in general, I don't know any successful members of AA who drink or use drugs. And so I've stuck to that. And even to this day, when I have to make a decision about something, it used to be I would have to figure out what I was going to do depending on what I thought you were going to do if I did that, or what you were going to do if I did this. Or my behavior was influenced by what I thought your behavior would be depending on what I did or didn't do. I remember early in sobriety, an Al-Anon lady said, the more you try to control another person, the more you are under that person's control. Because if what you do or how you feel next depends on whether that person does what you want them to do or doesn't do what you don't want them to do, then you're dependent on their feelings. You're under their control. If you follow that, you're an alcoholic. And today, I don't do that. I figure, when I have to decide on what to do, I ask myself, what would an AA winner do? What would a successful member of AA do? Or as Johnny A. says, I heard him one time say, ask the question, what would God want me to do? Or what's the loving thing to do? All of which are basically the same question. And if I do a thing for the right motive and leave the results up to God, I only have my half, one half of the equation. I don't have both sides of the equation. I just have my half. And all I have on my half is, what's my motive? And if my motive is right, and I leave the results up to God, it turns out the way it's supposed to. And but back in those days, when I was first getting sober, I was very ashamed of being in AA. I didn't want them out there to know I was here. I didn't want you to know I was here. To me, it really was the bottom of the barrel. And part of the embarrassment was you had such minor goals in life. You know, you this was really the bottom of the social barrel, and you had these real minor goals. I remember specifically a big, healthy, husky young guy stood up at the AA podium, and he very proudly said, "If I don't drink today, I'm a success today." And I thought, big damn deal, you know. His mommy would be really proud of him. He hasn't had a beer today, you know. That's the way you think when you're still drinking. But there came a day when it occurred to my brilliant mind that if that is such a stupid, little, chicken, dumb, almost nothing sort of goal, how come I can't do it? Yeah. I mean, if I can't make it here at the bottom of the, so, if I can't make it this, if I can't do this, there's nothing else that's going to count. Without this, nothing else matters. If I can't make it here, I can't make it anywhere. And that's when I decided I was going to be a successful member of AA. That became my goal. And to this day, that's been my goal. That's my goal today, to be a successful member of AA, a winner. To do everything I can to be the best AA member I can. Or to word it differently, to do everything I can to make AA succeed. To make AA a success in whatever AA is trying to do. To do nothing to harm AA, and everything I can to benefit AA. That's what we all do. That's why they say, you never say no to a reasonable AA request. You lead when you're asked to lead. You speak when you're asked to speak. You clean up when you're asked to speak and clean up. You do the things, with anything to participate and be part of and make it a better meeting because we're here. And that's been my goal, and I really enjoy that. I'm getting a little slowed down now because of the people in my head are talking. I have a slight pause while they have a committee meeting. You're sitting there very quietly and attentively, and I really appreciate that. And I'm trying to talk to you in somewhat of a straight line and make some coherence and sense to it. But up there, they don't do that. There's nobody in charge, and everybody's in charge. And they all talk and talk and talk. There's a lot of people. There are more people up there than there are out there. And you're quiet, but they're talking. And they talk. That's what they do up there. They talk. They talk. They talk. That's it. They just talk. They talk. They talk. They talk. They talk. They talk. And they talk. They don't do any work. They just talk. They talk. And they make suggestions and command. A lot of things they suggest are illegal and lewd. And I'm so glad you can't hear what I have to listen to. It's so embarrassing. And one of them started shouting about something I ought to talk about and started explaining why I shouldn't before they do anything. And I'm over here saying, no, don't talk about that. Start talking about this. And the middle one started jumping up and saying, no, don't talk about that. Don't talk about this. They get to fighting among themselves back there. And it's very distracting. And I think, oh, shut up there, you know. And they all shut up. And I can't think of anything to say. We get home, I'm physically tired, I want to lie down, go to sleep, and my brain will say, no, let's lie here and talk about it for a while. You know? Well, I'll get to sleep, and about 3 o'clock, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, they'll wake me up and say, hey, wake up, we've had an emergency meeting, and we need to talk to you. You know, you thought that thing you thought you did so well today, it went so well, wasn't like that at all. You know? They're really ticked off at you. Wait till morning, you'll find out. You know? And I think, well, I don't want to listen to that crap. And I'll roll over and go back to sleep. And just as I'm about to lose consciousness, I'll think to myself, boy, I'm glad I'm still not thinking about that. One of them will say, oh, I'm glad you're still awake. You know, you're one of the dumbest people we've ever worked with. You did the same dumb thing 6 months ago. Let's lie here and spend the rest of the night making lists of stupid things that you have done. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And that's the way my life is. That the quality of my life doesn't depend on what happens out there. The quality of my life depends on who of the people in my head I listen to who are analyzing what they think about what happened out there. And it's all personality. So there's only one up there that wants to see me drink. And whether it's too hot or too cold or too many people or not enough people or happy occasion or sad occasion, no matter what, it's if he says, "Oh, let's have a drink." And it used to be whenever he said that, I was almost like a command from God, I thought. And every time he took a drink, we all got drunk. But I find out that he's the only one that wants to see me drink. I used to fight with them, used to argue with them, used to use willpower to work with them. And that really energizes them. They really like that. They get really energized by that. I find it much easier to go along with them, not to do what they want, but to let them talk. And when they're through, say, "Well, thank you for participating. Now, if you'll sit down, we'll call on somebody else." Yeah. And if there are a whole bunch of them acting up, I think, "You guys need a meeting," and I'll take them off to a meeting. You know. But I don't fight with them. I just let them all talk, and then I make the final decision as to what we're going to do. Works much better that way. I went to meetings long enough to find out that if I wanted to stay sober, I had to keep going to meetings and not drink between meetings. As I did that and watched what was going on around me, I saw other people who got drunk going to meetings. Maybe a meeting every day. And then I realized if I want to stay sober, I got to work the steps. And so I got into the steps in order to stay sober. Not, as far as I can recall, not for any other reason, other than I wanted long-term sobriety on a one-day-at-a-time basis. And I kept watching other people, and I watched people who stayed sober going to meetings long enough to find out they had to work the steps in order to stay sober, who got drunk. Because after they worked the steps, they drifted away from the meetings. And the way I see it is, I go to meetings, don't drink between meetings, work the steps between meetings, and keep on going to meetings, and keep on working the steps. And I like it that way. I've been involved in a project about studying the steps with a pamphlet, and as a result of that, I've redone all the steps to the best of my ability about every 5 years. And every time I've done that, I've moved to a new plateau in my sobriety. And many, many times I've had people call me that on the advice of their sponsor, doesn't know what to do with them. And they've gotten tired of the program. They're not going to as many meetings, and they're not sponsoring anybody, and they don't have a sponsor anymore, and they're feeling kind of down and think maybe they need a therapist. And see a therapist, and the therapist thinks they're depressed, and maybe they ought to see a psychiatrist and see if they need antidepressants. And I've never seen anybody see a psychiatrist to find out if they needed antidepressants who was ever told no. I've often suggested that they maybe want to take antidepressants, I don't know. But before they do that, why don't they try redoing all the steps according to the pamphlet? And I've seen it happen many times that they were glad they had done that. I look at my watch, and I just want you to know it doesn't mean anything. I do that because I know it makes you feel better. But anyway, I will say one more thing. I was thinking of a graph. If I had a graph of my life, I think it would look like a giant V, like the Jelinek chart. My life started way, way over there, and it's going to end way, 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 way over there. And from where it started until July 31st, 1967, it was on a downhill course. Now, it wasn't a straight line down. It was up and down. Just enough ups to keep me confused. I ended up in the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. That wasn't bad enough. I had to go to AA. Went to AA for 7 months. Went to one meeting too many. And on July 31st, 1967, I accepted the fact that I, of all people, strange as it might seem, and even though I had no choice in the matter, had never once decided that I wanted to be an alcoholic, I had nothing to do with being an alcoholic. Through no fault of my own, I found that I really was a mild alcoholic. My life from since then has been getting better and better and better. And my disease has been getting worse and worse and worse. I'm much more alcoholic than I was when I first became alcoholic. So it's a progressive disease, even in recovery. But the nice part about it is also a progressive recovery. It's even more progressive in recovery. My life's better today than it's ever been. It's higher on this side than it's ever been over here. And I know of nothing. The only thing I know of that's going to control how high it goes on this side is how long I keep doing what I'm doing today that's keeping it on an uphill curve. And I want all I can get of this program. I want all I can get. I can't get it all. Nobody can live long enough to get all this program has to offer. But I want all I can get. And so I'm going to keep doing the things I'm doing. And it isn't a straight line up. It's up and down. But when it does go down, there are all kinds of things I can do. Read the book, go to more meetings, talk to some newcomers, call my sponsor, read the book. There's all kinds of things I can do to get it to go back up. Or I can do nothing. I can just sit still and wait, and it'll get better. That's the only Bible quote I use. Bible says, and it came to pass. The Bible didn't say, and it came to say. Winnie Eddy always used to say that. And I'm thoroughly convinced that when people like us hurt, we either drink or grow. And if we hurt, we don't drink, we get to the other end of it, we're spiritually stronger than we were before we went into it. So that all pain becomes growing pain if we don't drink. But when we have a problem, we end up spiritually different than we started. We're either better off or worse off, depending on whether we drink or take drugs or break our sobriety. So all pain is growth pain. And one last thought. I'm so impressed with that one act of acceptance, accepting that one basic truth or reality about my life changed the course of my life from getting progressively worse to getting progressively better. And I see it all the time now. Anything in life, if I don't accept it, if I don't accept the reality of that situation, it keeps getting worse until I accept it. And when I accept it, then it starts to keeps getting better. It happens all the time. Well, why did it take me so many years to accept that one obvious reality of my life, that I was an alcoholic? And the only answer I can come up with is I confused acceptance with approval. I did not approve of me being an alcoholic. And since I didn't approve of it, I couldn't accept it. And because I couldn't accept it, there was nothing I could do about it. But acceptance is empowering. Once I accepted the reality, the truth of my life, then I had choices of what I could do about it. And it's that way all the way through life. I have to be careful not to confuse acceptance and approval. They're two very different. Approval is an impediment to acceptance. And I didn't approve it when I accepted it. Today I now approve of it. Today I approve of the fact that I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I like being an alcoholic. I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. And if it bothers you to hear me say that, that's too damn bad. If you don't understand it, ask your sponsor. If your sponsor doesn't understand it, get a new sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor, get a sponsor. I mean, they say it all the time in AA. Everybody should have a sponsor. Everybody should have a sponsor. Not only should you have a sponsor, everybody should be a sponsor. If you're not sponsoring anybody, for God's sake, grab somebody and start sponsoring them. It's a really way to go. I mean, don't tell me you don't know how to do it. That's how you learn how to do it, is by being one. It's that way with everybody. What is it? Somebody who used the phrase regarding sponsors, they said, have one and be one. And it's a lot of fun. And don't just screw up your own life. Screw up somebody else's too. Thank you all very much.
All right, that was a great talk. We're going to move on next to a talk Dr. Paul gave on March 1st of 1968. It's a talk I took off of a reel-to-reel that an old-timer in the area gave me to try to transcribe, and ran into some sound quality problems on the back side. But the first side was pretty good in the first 30-40 minutes or so of the tape, but we're only going to run about a 10, maybe 15 minute segment off this. But I think you'll enjoy this.
Well, I'm Paul Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic. I suppose I could or should start out like many a speaker I've heard say that they were not a member of the Speakers Bureau on the Speakers Panel, and then spend an hour and a half proving the point. So I'll just prove my point and let you draw your own conclusion. I had spoken at an impromptu meeting New Year's Eve, and which came as close to my birthday as I'll ever have a birthday, since I don't know just when I came in here. And then I went with my wife to the first Al-Anon meeting I'd ever gone to, and I'll never go back. Because the speaker didn't show up, and so I had to talk then. And then Harry caught me one night, and he said that the speaker for a Thursday night couldn't make it, and they had absolutely nobody. That didn't make sense. They had absolutely nobody to speak, but would I speak? So I said to my wife, I said, well, I've already said this stuff to people. What can I say different? And she says, well, you tell your story. It's what happened, and you tell it. And some other useless comments that didn't help at all. So if you've heard it before and you get nothing out of it, don't be surprised. I guess most speakers start out with their childhood and how they became, why they became alcoholic relatives and parents and split homes and so on. And the closest I can remember about alcohol in my home was, well, I was raised in a drugstore. The home and the drugstore were part of the same building, and you never could tell where one ended and the other stopped, including the family fights and everything else. But I can remember my old man standing at the ice cabinet drinking a can of near beer and cursing the stuff because it didn't taste like real beer to him. I don't recall him ever drinking anything heavy, and I remember one time a story about my mother coming home from the neighbors, and he accused her of having had too much to drink, and she took a vow she'd never drink again, and so I could hardly call her an alcoholic. And I got two sisters that are a bit on the screwy side, but they're not alcoholic. And I had one brother, an old guy. I'm the youngest of the four children, and my older brother, he worked himself to death and died before he had a chance to become an alcoholic. But Max, my wife, she was an orphan, and she was raised by her grandmother, And then later on was raised by her aunt and uncle. And this uncle was a pretty good drunkard. So I guess the closest I can come to blaming it on anybody is that I have an alcoholic uncle-in-law. But and it seems to me that that really I guess it comes down to the fact that the reason I'm an alcoholic is that I drank too much, too often, for too long, and lost control. I used to think when I first came to these meetings that you said alcohol was cunning, baffling, and powerful, and that that was a lot of nonsense because there was nothing cunning or baffling about it because I had it under complete control. And it was powerful because it helped me a great deal. And it helped me through many years of college. I would work my way through college and worked in college, and Max, when we were married, worked my way through medical school, and I would be able to go to school all day, work all evening, come home and study like mad, and then either go to bed and be half awake and half asleep and not get a good night's sleep and have everything I had studied get all scrambled up and wake up tired and stupid, or I could take a couple of beers and go right to sleep and wake up in the morning refreshed and smart. And using this technique, I was able to graduate with honors, even as I went through school. And I just started in pharmacy school. I can remember then my mother would send me down with my brother-in-law to the local pub after they had, like in Ohio, they had 3-2 beer on Sundays and 7% beer the other times or something like that. And she'd tell me to go down and get some beer and be sure and bring some home, and she didn't want me to be ashamed to drink at home. And I really learned my lesson well. I was a lone drinker from then on, and I never drank in bars, and I didn't like bars, and I didn't like people that were intoxicated. And besides, if they talked, they interfered with these wild dreams I had of things how I was going to. Hey, that song, I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire, and at that time, there was nothing less true. I did want to set it on fire, and I was going to do it with the aid of alcohol if all these programs would just work out right. And it seemed like they did for a while until it collapsed. But when we were in pharmacy school, and I never did like that. I didn't think that that was a way to raise kids in a drugstore. And one time they were having a family squabble. Max and I had to live there with my mother at the store at the time, and my sisters would come in and start raising hell. And they had a big fight, and I was working away and didn't say anything. And they finally said, "Well, what about you? What do you think?" And I said, "I don't think anything. I don't give a damn what you decide. We're pulling out, and we're going to leave." And with that, we bundled up everything we had, which wasn't much, and threw it in one car and went off, not knowing where, but ended up at the state university in graduate work in biochemistry and materia medica, pharmacology, the study of drugs and the actions of drugs on the human body and the proper dosage and the treatment of poisoning thereof and so on. And I found myself working as a graduate assistant, which was like an assistant to one of the professors or teachers, teaching these medical students this stuff, and teaching them, for one thing, like how to write prescriptions so that nobody but doctors or druggists could read them, and stuff like that. And my immediate superior, kept saying that I should go into medical school. And for 3 years, we argued because I knew I was too stupid to ever be able to make it through medical school, and he didn't think so. And then to show how stupid I am, I graduated with honor. And so I don't know how it just shows how I can get things screwed up, but I'm sure I couldn't have done it without alcohol. But it took more and more alcohol as the days and the weeks and months and years went by. And then after I got through medical school, I went to New York for 2 years internship, and then I spent 5 years specializing in internal medicine, which is the diagnosis of people's troubles. And most of the work in that line is done by talking to people and letting them talk, asking pertinent questions and getting them to talk about the things that are really the root of the trouble, and then doing a physical exam and the laboratory work and deciding what was wrong and what ought to be done about it. But the important part is history taking, and I could do this. I treated a lot of doctors' families, and I had a large practice, and I could work this with people, and it seemed to help a lot of people, and a lot of them seemed to think I had. And my point being that the only reasonable assumption would be that if I could do that, talking to somebody sitting on the other side of the desk, I could do the same thing with a guy talking to me in the mirror. But it didn't work out that way. I think it's because the guy in the mirror and I were lying to each other, where the other time people were honest. But I didn't feel that I had any... there was a time that I felt that I needed to control my drinking, and I tried many of the things listed in Chapter 3. I remember particularly the one time my wife liked scotch and soda, and I hate scotch and I can't stand soda. But we were going to go out to a dinner dance, and I can't stand dinner dances worth a damn. And I was going to be among people where it would be very important that they not get a wrong impression and think that I perhaps have a drinking problem. So I thought, well, the simplest thing is I'll just drink scotch and soda. And contrary to what the book says, it worked. It worked fine. I think I only had 2 drinks all evening and stayed quite sober and stayed all evening. And when we got home, then I got drunk and went to bed. But from that time on, we bought the scotch by the case. And I still can't stand soda. My first immediate problem after that was that we put kids to bed, and Max and I sit in the living room, and we both agreed we'd have a scotch and soda. And then I hadn't figured out a way that you could mix one scotch and soda with a tall highball glass and one jigger of scotch and the rest soda, and the rest with a hell of a lot more scotch and less soda, and make them come out the same color. And she'd always notice it, so I'd keep trying to make hers a little stronger. And I put in a half a jigger extra. She knew it. She said, "Oh, God, you make strong drinks." And she'd say it in a way that sounded like, "You must be a drunk or something like that." And I said, "That's all right, I'll drink that one." And I have to drink it. It wasn't funny. It wasn't funny because it had all that goddamn soda in it. And I'd have to drink some off and pour in some scotch and fill it up and drink some off and pour in some scotch. And then she'd sit at the couch here and have her drink sitting on the arm of the couch, and I'd sit in the easy chair this way, and my drink is on the arm of the chair. And she could notice the difference in color that way. Plus the fact that the glass had a habit of falling off on the floor. So I got in the habit of putting my glass down on the floor where she couldn't see it. Her drink was sitting up here and mine was down on the floor. And so using that method, I was able to eliminate this terrible soda. And I would mix my drinks with scotch and 3 ice cubes in the tall highball glass. And I'd add a twist of lemon. I thought that was real nice. The first thing to go was the lemon. And then I stopped adding the ice cubes, because it didn't seem to improve it any that it was chilled, and it didn't need it chilled. And the best part of all was she'd drink one drink and get sleepy and go to bed, and then I could really drink. She never liked the way I watched television, and anyhow, because when I watch television, I can't find one channel that's worth watching, so I watch them all. I keep turning.